Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 171st of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm FNH. Today we're starting off with the second part of the 39 Steps, a pre-World War I drama. Then we'll have a musical number from 1924 to pick up the pace, and then on to part 7 of our classic tale of horror, The Wendigo. Let's get started. Chapter 2. The Milkman Sets Out on His Travels. I sat down in an armchair and felt very sick. That lasted for maybe 5 minutes and was succeeded by a fit of the horrors. The poor, staring white face on the floor was more than I could bear, and I managed to get a tablecloth and cover it. And then I staggered to a cupboard, found the brandy, and swallowed several mouthfuls. I'd seen men die violently before. Indeed, I had killed a few myself in the Matabele War. But this cold-blooded indoor business was different. Still, I managed to pull myself together. I looked at my watch and saw that it was 10:30. An idea seized me, and I went over the flat with a small tooth comb, and there was nobody there, nor any trace of anybody. But I shuttered and bolted all the windows and put the chain on the door. By this time, my wits were coming back to me, and I could think again. It took me about an hour to figure the thing out, and I did not hurry, for unless my murderer came back, I had till about 6 o'clock in the morning for my cogitations. I was in the soup, that was pretty clear. Any shadow of doubt I might have had about the truth of Scudder's tale was now gone. The proof of it was lying under the tablecloth. The men who knew that he knew what he knew had found him, and had taken the best way to make certain of his silence. Yes, but he had been in my rooms for 4 days, and his enemies must have reckoned that he had confided in me, so I would be the next to go. Might be that very night, or the next day, or the day after, but my number was all up. And then suddenly I thought of another probability. Supposing I went out now and called in the police, or went to bed and let Paddock find the body and call them in the morning. What kind of a story was I to tell about Scudder? I'd lied to Paddock about him, and the whole thing looked desperately fishy. If I made a clean breast of it and told the police everything he had told me, they would simply laugh at me. The odds were 1,000 to 1 that I would be charged with the murder, and the circumstantial evidence was strong enough to hang me. Few people knew me in England. I had no real pal who could come forward and swear to my character. Perhaps that was what the secret enemies were playing for. They were clever enough for anything, and an English prison was as good a way of getting rid of me till after June the 15th as a knife in my chest. Besides, if I told the whole story, and by any miracle was believed, I would be playing their game. Carolides would stay at home, which was what they wanted. Somehow or other, the sight of Scudder's dead face had made me a passionate believer in his scheme. He was gone, but he had taken me into his confidence, and I was pretty well bound to carry on his work. You may think this ridiculous for a man in danger of his life, but that was the way I looked at it. I am an ordinary sort of fellow, not braver than other people, but I hate to see a good man downed, and that long knife would not be the end of Scudder if I could play the game in his place. It took me an hour or two to think this out, and by that time I had come to a decision. I must vanish somehow, and keep vanished until the end of the second week in June. And then I must somehow find a way to get in touch with the government people, and tell them what Scudder had told me. I wish to heaven he had told me more, and that I had listened more carefully to the little he had told me. I knew nothing but the barest facts. There was a big risk that even if I weathered the other dangers, I would not be believed in the end. I must take my chance of that, and hope that something might happen which would confirm my tale in the eyes of the government. My first job was to keep going for the next 3 weeks. It was now the 24th of May, and that meant 20 days of hiding before I could venture to approach the powers that be. I reckoned that two sets of people would be looking for me, Scudder's enemies to put me out of existence, and the police, who would want me for Scudder's murder. It was going to be a giddy hunt, and it was queer how the prospect comforted me. I'd been slack for so long that almost any chance of activity was welcome. When I had to sit alone with that corpse and wait on fortune, I was no better than a crushed worm. But if my neck's safety was to hang on my own wits, I was prepared to be cheerful about it. My next thought was whether Scudder had any papers about him to give me a better clue to the business. I drew back the tablecloth and searched his pockets, for I had no longer any shirking from the body. The face was wonderfully calm for a man who had been struck down in a moment. There was nothing in the breast pocket, and only a few loose coins and a cigar holder in the waistcoat. The trousers held a little penknife and some silver, and the side pocket of his jacket contained an old crocodile skin cigar case. There was no sign of the little black book in which I had seen him making notes. That had no doubt been taken by his murderer. But as I looked up from my task, I saw that some drawers had been pulled out in the writing table. Scudder would never have left them in that state, for he was the tidiest of mortals. Someone must have been searching for something, perhaps the pocketbook. I went round the flat and found that everything had been ransacked, the inside of books, drawers, cupboards, boxes, and even the pockets of the clothes in my wardrobe, and the sideboard in the dining room. There was no trace of the book. Most likely the enemy had found it, but they had not found it on Scudder's body. Then I got out an atlas and looked at a big map of the British Isles. My notion was to get off to some wild district, where my Veldcraft would be of some use to me, for I would be like a trapped rat in the city. I considered that Scotland would be best, for my people were Scotch, and I could pass anywhere as an ordinary Scotsman. I had half an idea at first to be a German tourist, for my father had had German partners, and I'd been brought up to speak the tongue pretty fluently, not to mention having put in 3 years of prospecting for copper in German Damaraland. But I calculated that it would be less conspicuous to be a Scot, and less in a line with what the police might know of my past. I fixed on Galloway as the best place to go. It was the nearest wild part of Scotland, so far as I could figure it out, and from the look of the map was not over thick with population. A search in Bradshaw informed me that a train left St. Pancras at 7:10, which would land me at Galloway station in the late afternoon. That was well enough, but a more important matter was how I was to make my way to St. Pancras, for I was pretty certain the Scudder's friends would be watching outside. This puzzled me for a bit, and then I had an inspiration on which I went to bed and slept for 2 troubled hours. I got up at 4 and opened my bedroom shutters. The faint light of a fine summer morning was flooding the skies, and the sparrows had begun to chatter. I had a great revulsion of feeling, and felt a God-forgotten fool. My inclination was to let things slide and trust to the British police taking a reasonable view of my case. But as I reviewed the situation, I could find no arguments to bring against my decision of the previous night. So with a wry mouth, I resolved to go on with my plan. I was not feeling in any particular funk, only disinclined to go on, looking for trouble, if you understand me. I hunted out a well-used tweed suit, a pair of strong nailed boots, and a flannel shirt with a collar. Into my pockets I stuffed a spare shirt, a cloth cap, some handkerchiefs, and a toothbrush. I'd drawn a good sum of gold from the bank 2 days before in case Scudder should want money, and I took £50 of it with me in sovereigns in a belt which I had brought back from Rhodesia. That was about all I wanted. Then I had a bath and cut my moustache, which was long and drooping, into a short stubbly fringe. Now came the next step. Paddock used to arrive punctually at 7:30 and let himself in with a latchkey. But about 7:20, as I knew from bitter experience, The milkman turned up with a great clatter of cans and deposited my share outside my door. I'd seen that milkman sometimes when I'd gone out for an early ride. He was a young man about my own height with an ill-nourished moustache, and he wore a white overall. On him, I staked all my chances. I went into the darkened smoking room where the rays of morning light were beginning to creep through the shutters. There I breakfasted off a whiskey and soda and some biscuits from the cupboard. By this time, it was getting on for 6 o'clock. I put a pipe in my pocket and filled my pouch from the tobacco jar on the table by the fireplace. As I poked into the tobacco, my fingers touched something hard, and I drew out Scudder's little black pocketbook. That seemed to me a good omen. I lifted the cloth from the body and was amazed at the peace and dignity of the dead face. "Goodbye, old chap," I said. "I'm going to do my best for you. Wish me well, wherever you are." Then I hung about in the hall, waiting for the milkman. That was the worst part of the business, for I was fairly choking to get out of the doors. 6:30 passed, and then 6:40, but still he did not come. The fool had chosen this day of all days to be late. At 1 minute after the 6:45, I heard the rattle of the cans outside. I opened the front door, and there was my man singling out my cans from a bunch he carried and whistling through his teeth. He jumped a bit at the sight of me. "Come in here a moment," I said. "I want a word with you." And I led him into the dining room. "I reckon you're a bit of a sportsman," I said. "And I want you to do me a service. Lend me your cap and overall for 10 minutes, and here's a sovereign for you." His eyes opened at the sight of the gold, and he grinned broadly. "What's the game?" he asked. "A bet," I said. "I haven't time to explain, but to win it, I've got to be a milkman for the next 10 minutes. All you've got to do is to stay here till I come back. You'll be a bit late, but nobody will complain, and you'll have that quid for yourself." "Righto," he said cheerily. "I ain't the man to spoil a bit of sport. Here's the rig, governor." I stuck on his flat blue cap and his white overall, picked up the cans, banged my door, and went whistling downstairs. The porter at the foot told me to shut my jaw, which sounded as if my makeup was adequate. At first I thought there was nobody in the street, and then I caught sight of a policeman 100 yards down and a loafer shuffling past on the other side. Some impulse made me raise my eyes to the house opposite, and there, at the first floor window, was a face. As the loafer passed, he looked up, and I fancied a signal was exchanged. I crossed the street, whistling gaily and imitating the jaunty swing of the milkman. Then I took the first side street and went up a left-hand turning which led past a bit of vacant ground. There was no one in the little street, so I dropped the milk cans inside the hoarding and sent the cap and overall after them. I had only just put on my cloth cap when a postman came round the corner. I gave him a good morning, and he answered me unsuspiciously. At that moment, the clock of a neighbouring church struck the hour of 7. There was not a second to spare. As soon as I got to Euston Road, I took to my heels and ran. The clock at Euston Station showed 5 minutes past the hour. At St Pancras, I had no time to take a ticket, let alone that I had not settled upon my destination. A porter told me the platform, and as I entered it, I saw the train already in motion. 2 station officials blocked the way, but I dodged them and clambered into the last carriage. 3 minutes later, as we were roaring through the northern tunnels, an irate guard interviewed me. He wrote out for me a ticket to Newton Stewart, a name which had suddenly come back to my memory, and he conducted me from the first-class compartment where I had ensconced myself to a third-class smoker, occupied by a sailor and a stout woman with a child. He went off grumbling, and as I mopped my brow, I observed to my companions in the broadest Scots that it was a sore job catching trains. I'd already entered upon my part. "The impudence of that guard," said the lady bitterly. "He needed a Scotch tongue to pit him in his place. He was complaining of this wee and their haying a ticket, and her no foa till August 12th, and he was objecting to this gentleman spitting." The sailor morosely agreed, and I started my new life in an atmosphere of protest against authority. I reminded myself that a week ago I'd been finding the world dull. Today's music is by Nathan Glantz, and it's a 1924 track called June Night. And now on to today's main horror feature. This is part 7 of The Wendigo. Part 7. A wall of silence wrapped them in, for the snow, though not thick, was sufficient to deaden any noise, and the frost held things pretty tight besides. No sound but their voices, and the soft roar of the flames made itself heard. Only, from time to time, something soft as the flutter of a pine moth's wings went past them through the air. No one seemed anxious to go to bed. The hours slipped towards midnight. "The legend is picturesque enough," observed the doctor after one of the longer pauses, speaking to break it rather than because he had anything to say. "For the Wendigo is simply the call of the wild personified, which some natures hear to their own destruction." "That's about it," Hank said presently. and there's no misunderstanding when you hear it. It calls you by name right enough." Another pause followed, and then Dr. Cathcart came back to the forbidden subject with a rush that made the others jump. "The allegory is significant," he remarked, looking about him into the darkness. "For the voice, they say, resembles all the minor sounds of the bush, wind, falling water, cries of the animals, and so forth. And once the victim hears that, he's off for good, of course. His most vulnerable points, moreover, are said to be the feet and the eyes. The feet, you see, for the lust of wandering, and the eyes for the lust of beauty. The poor beggar goes at such a dreadful speed that he bleeds beneath the eyes, and feet burn." Dr. Cathcart, as he spoke, continued to peer uneasily into the surrounding gloom. His voice sank to a hushed tone. "The Wendigo," he added, "is said to burn his feet, owing to the friction, apparently caused by its tremendous velocity, till they drop off, and new ones form exactly like its own." Simpson listened in horrified amazement, but it was the pallor on Hank's face that fascinated him most. He would willingly have stopped his ears and closed his eyes had he dared. "It don't always keep to the ground, neither," came in Hank's slow, heavy drawl, "for it goes so high that he thinks the stars have set him all afire, and it'll take great thumping jumps sometimes, and run along the tops of the trees carrying its partner with it, and then dropping him, just as a fishhawk'll drop a pickerel to kill it before eating. Its food, of all the muck in the whole bush, is moss." And he laughed, a short, unnatural laugh. "It's a moss-eater, is the Wendigo," he added, looking up excitedly into the faces of his companions. "Moss-eater," he repeated, with a string of the most outlandish oaths he could invent. But Simpson now understood the true purpose of all this talk. What these two men, each strong and experienced in his own way, dreaded more than anything else was silence. They were talking against time. They were also talking against the darkness, against the invasion of panic, against the admission reflection might bring that they were in an enemy's country. Against anything, in fact, rather than allow their innermost thoughts to assume control. He himself, already initiated by the awful vigil with terror, was beyond both of them in this respect. He had reached the stage where he was immune. But these two, the scoffing analytical doctor and the honest, dogged backwoodsman, each sat trembling in the depths of his being. Thus the hours passed, and thus, with lowered voices and a kind of taut inner resistance of spirit, this little group of humanity sat in the jaws of the wilderness and talked foolishly of the terrible and haunting legend. It was an unequal contest, all things considered, for the wilderness had already the advantage of first attack and of a hostage. The fate of their comrade hung over them with a steadily increasing weight of oppression that finally became insupportable. It was Hank, after a pause longer than the preceding ones, and that no one seemed able to break, who first let loose all of this pent-up emotion in a very unexpected fashion, by springing suddenly to his feet and letting out the most ear-shattering yell imaginable into the night. He could not contain himself any longer. To make it carry, even beyond the ordinary cry, he interrupted its rhythm by shaking the palm of his hand before his mouth. "That's for Defago," he said, looking down at the other two with a queer defiant laugh. "For it's my belief, the sandwiched oaths may be omitted, that old partner's not far from us at this very minute." There was a vehemence and a recklessness about his performance that made Simpson too start to his feet in amazement, and betrayed even the doctor into letting his pipe slip from between his lips. Hank's face was ghastly, but Cathcart's showed a sudden weakness, a loosening of all his faculties, as it were. Then a momentary anger blazed into his eyes, and he too, though with deliberation born of habitual self-control, got upon his feet and faced the excited guide. For this was unpermissible, foolish, dangerous, and he meant to stop it in the bud. What might have happened in the next minute or two, one may speculate about, yet never definitely know. For in the instant of profound silence that followed Hank's roaring voice, and as though in answer to it, something went past through the darkness of the sky overhead at terrific speed. Something of necessity very large, for it displaced much air, whilst down between the trees there fell a faint and windy cry of a human voice, calling in tones of indescribable anguish and appeal. "Oh, oh, this fiery height! Oh, oh, my feet of fire! My burning feet of fire!" White to the very edge of his shirt, Hank looked stupidly about him like a child. Dr. Cathcart uttered some kind of unintelligible cry, turning as he did so with an instinctive movement of blind terror towards the protection of the tent, and then halting in this act as though frozen. Simpson, alone of the three, retained his presence of mind a little. His own horror was too deep to allow of any immediate action. He had heard that cry before. Turning to his stricken companions, he said almost calmly, "That's exactly the cry I heard, the very words he used." And then, lifting his face to the sky, he cried aloud, "Defago! Defago, come down to us here! Come down!" And before there was time for anybody to take definite action one way or another, there came the sound of something dropping heavily between the trees, striking the branches on the way down, and landing with a dreadful thud upon the frozen earth below. The crash and thunder of it was really terrific. "That's him. So help me, for Gawd," came from Hank in a whispering cry, half choked, his hand going automatically towards the hunting knife in his belt. "And he's coming. He's coming," he added with an irrational laugh of horror, as the sounds of heavy footsteps crunching over the snow became distinctly audible, approaching through the blackness towards the circle of light. And while the steps, with their stumbling motion, moved nearer and nearer upon them, the three men stood round that fire, motionless and dumb. Dr. Cathcart had the appearance of a man suddenly withered. Even his eyes did not move. Hank, suffering shockingly, seemed on the verge again of violent action, yet did nothing. He too was hewn of stone. Like stricken children they seemed, the picture was hideous, and meanwhile, their owner still invisible, the footsteps came closer, crunching the frozen snow. It was endless, too prolonged to be quite real, this measured and pitiless approach. It was accursed. Well, that's it for today. Opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project, and this file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time. CthulhuPodcast.co.uk